Hello and welcome to Employment Talk. We're here to discuss the HR issues affecting you and keep you up to date with the latest employment law news. My name is Jo Mosley. I'm a support lawyer in the employment team at Irwin Mitchell. I write our blogs and newsletters, and I keep the team and our clients up to date with what's happening in the world of employment law.
And my name's Elaine Hutley. I'm national head of our wonderful employment team, working with clients to help them navigate the ever more complex world of employing colleagues.
Indeed. How are you, Elaine?
I'm really good, thanks, Jo. I enjoyed a trip to our new London offices this week that we officially opened last week, but it was my first chance to get down there. And it was really great to see everyone excited by the new space.
Is it quite posh?
Oh, it's lovely. It's really nice. And it's down by Blackfriars, and I had to come up by the side of the river to get into the offices. So, yeah, it is a lovely space. And yeah, the team down there were very, very excited. But enough about me, Jo. What are we going to be discussing today?
Well, there's been a fair bit of coverage recently about the government's decision to reintroduce liability for employers whose staff are harassed by third parties at work. And I had a quick look at some of the headlines, and they range from what I can only describe as being hysterical. So a couple of examples are pub landlords will be turned into banter police, and that the free speech crackdown will erase, and erase is in capital letters, the good old British pub. To the more somewhat sympathetic, but certainly there are more posts suggesting that it's the end of the world as we know it than more considered pieces. So I thought we could explain what the new duty requires of employers, and we'll look at the definition of harassment, because it's not just about how someone reacts. We'll look at where there might be pinch points for employers, and then have a chat about how they can start to prepare.
And it's also really timely, isn't it, Jo, because we recently did a webinar on this topic, which we discussed in much more detail than we'll be able to go through today. And we're also going to be rolling out some training, just because our clients and contacts have been asking if we can, along the lines of other subjects that we have done before. So I guess if anybody does want a copy of the recording, it is available on our YouTube channel. If you couldn't make the seminar, please let Jo or I know and we'll share it on. Or if you would like to express an interest in the training that we're preparing again, please let us know and we'll put you on the list for that.
Great plug. Okay, so before we get into the detail, can you please give our listeners a brief history of third-party harassment and what protections are already in place, Elaine?
Yeah, of course. So in reality, there was practically no protection prior to 2010 when the Equality Act was introduced, other than in the context of sexual harassment. So employees might have been able to bring a constructive unfair dismissal claim on the basis that the employer had breached the implied duty of trust and confidence by not dealing with the situation, but that didn't cover one-off incidents. So the employee really had to get to the point where they were saying that the situation is intolerable and I want you to do something about it. Now, obviously, that only applies if the individual in question is an employee. So there was no help for workers, etc. Plus, they also had to have a minimum length of service, which has ranged over the years from 6 months to 2 years. So basically, employers were only responsible under discrimination law if they had an ability to control the situation and therefore have prevented it or reduced the extent of it.
Yes, I mean, there was a really infamous case involving Bernard Manning. I think it was 1996 or thereabouts anyway. So you were probably still at school, Elaine.
I was, just. I'm giving my age away.
That involved a couple of black waitresses who were exposed to racist abuse by the comedian and also by various members of the audience that were at this sort of banquet at a hotel. Now, Manning's views were well known, and the court said that their employers were liable because they should have expected that these waitresses might be harassed and should have taken steps to prevent it. Now, that case was found to have been wrongly decided a few years later by the House of Lords, and that narrowed the scope further. And that involved a case involving a teacher who was subjected to homophobic comments by pupils. And the House of Lords said that employers would only be liable for the behaviour of third parties, which in this case was pupils. If the reason the school hadn't stopped the abuse was because it was treating this particular teacher less favourably because of her sexuality, then it would have treated other and it would have treated other complaints differently.
Yeah. Now, and this comment is probably going to make me sound really old to some of our listeners, but in reality, those cases weren't that long ago. And it's shocking now to think that it was the stance at the time. And I know a lot of our listeners are going to think that 1996 is positively prehistoric, but actually it isn't. These things were happening in our lifetime. But the landscape has changed massively since then. And it's not to say that there isn't still more to do, but I think we do need to recap of what the response was at the time and how things have changed. So at the time, the government did change the Sex Discrimination Act to include third-party harassment for repeated acts, but it didn't cover any other strand of discrimination. So it's purely under the Sex Discrimination Act. And then that didn't change until 2010, when the government introduced third-party liability in the Equality Act. And then that did apply to all protected characteristics, not just sex.
So can I ask you to briefly explain then how third-party liability worked under the Equality Act, as the new provisions are going to be somewhat different?
So when it was introduced, an employer would only be liable if a member of staff was harassed by a third party whilst they were at work, if it hadn't taken all reasonable steps to prevent it. But there was a really big proviso, and that was that the employee had to have been harassed on at least two previous occasions, and the employer had to know about it. And if they were, they were then liable for the third act of harassment.
Those provisions were repealed in 2013 by the coalition government. Can you remember what reason they gave, Elaine?
Vaguely. Didn't they say something about them not being necessary or something like that?
Yeah, I remember lawyers raising their eyebrows at the time, not least because the government said that there were existing laws that already protected staff in this way, which, as you've already outlined, didn't really protect them at all. And I also think it was part of the government's drive at that time to reduce bureaucracy. And it also said something about employers only having limited control over the actions of third parties as well. But I'm not sure that I think that's been a pretty big fail, actually.
Yeah, it wasn't great. But anyway, next part in the history lesson is that the government did include third-party harassment in the law which came to force in October last year, which required employers to prevent sexual harassment. But there was no freestanding right for an employee to bring a claim for sexual harassment against their employer if it involved a third party. So an employee in that situation couldn't get compensation. It's the Equality and Human Rights Commission, which are the only body that can take enforcement action against employers in these circumstances.
This is turning into a longer history lesson than I intended, so perhaps we need to move on to what's being proposed.
Okay, so I think it's worth bearing in mind that third-party harassment was a manifesto pledge for the government to reintroduce the concept of third-party harassment. So it was included in the Employment Rights Bill, which, as everybody should know, is currently being debated in Parliament, because you and I have discussed this a fair few times over recent podcasts. Mm-hmm. But in relation to third-party harassment, the section in the Employment Rights Bill is actually relatively short, and what it will do is add in a new section to the Equality Act.
Okay, so what does this short section say?
Simply, it says that the employer will be liable if a member of their staff is harassed in the course of their employment by a third party where they, the employer, fail to take all reasonable steps to prevent it.
So there's no requirement for the employee in question to have been harassed previously. And potentially then employers are going to be liable, or could be liable, the first time it happens.
Yeah, absolutely. It's no three strikes and you're out. It's a much more onerous provision. And employers will only be able to escape liability if they have taken all, little word, big impact, all reasonable steps to prevent it. And we'll come on to what that means in a few minutes. But listeners who are familiar with this test in other contexts will know that it can be really difficult to prove you've done everything you could have done to prevent your staff from being harassed.
Okay, thank you for that. So before we go on to consider banter, because that's one of the issues I really want us to focus on. I think it might be a good idea just to remind our listeners about what the legal test for harassment actually involves, because it's often misrepresented, and people seem to think that if they're offended by something, then that's enough.
Yeah, that's right. So it's important to bear in mind that there are three key strands to the test, and I'm going to take you through each of these briefly. So firstly, the employee must be subject to what the legislation refers to as unwanted conduct, that is related to a protected characteristic. And remember that that relates to all protected characteristics. In that context, unwanted is fairly self-explanatory. It means something that the other person doesn't want or hasn't asked for. The next part of the test is that it must have the purpose or effect of violating the person's dignity or creating an intimidating, hostile, degrading, humiliating, or offensive environment. So that part is pretty widely drawn. Yeah. At this stage, the tribunal looks at the effect on the victim, and that's subjective. And by that, I mean it's down to the individual and their point of view. And it's worth bearing in mind that you can't expect everyone to react in the same way. Yeah. But, and this is the bit that often gets overlooked, it's the last part of the test, and it is that the tribunal will then consider whether it's reasonable for what has happened to the employee to have that effect. And so it's this final step and final consideration that introduces an element of objectivity.
Yes, and that's really important, isn't it? Because it's not just about people saying they are uncomfortable around other people or they feel unsafe. It's got to be objectively reasonable for them to feel that way.
Yeah, absolutely.
There was a case a few years ago in the Court of Appeal where they said that being upset, and this is a quote here, being upset is far from attracting the epithets required to constitute harassment. And I think that sums it up quite nicely.
Yeah, that's right, Jo, I agree. And it's worth bearing in mind that the tribunal will consider all of the circumstances. Yeah. So if we compare a situation where a customer or a client racially abuses a member of staff with another situation where an employee overhears customers making racist jokes, in the first example, it will amount to harassment. The customer's purpose is to create that hostile, intimidating environment. The second example around overheard comments is much more difficult to call. And I'm not saying it isn't harassment, but the facts and circumstances will be carefully considered.
Yeah, I agree. It will all come down to whether it's reasonable for the employee to feel the way they do. And I've got a really good example to illustrate this, which I saw on LinkedIn a couple of months ago. So this exchange took place on the day the Supreme Court handed down its judgment in the Four Women Scotland case. And that was the case that talked about what sex means in the Equality Act. And we discussed that at our last podcast. Now, I'm not entirely sure whether it was the Four Women Scotland, so the claimants themselves, or people that were associated with them. But anyway, they rocked up to a Wetherspoons pub when they got off the train, and they went there for a celebratory drink. And the Post said that after they'd been served their first drinks, and they were obviously chatting about the decision, they were overheard by some of the bar staff who initially refused to serve them again because they said they felt unsafe. And the Post intimated that they'd got in touch with Tim Martin, so the owner of Wetherspoons, and that they were served pretty quickly afterwards. Now, I can't see how that sort of interaction will impose liability on an employer, because it's not objectively reasonable for staff to feel harassed just by overhearing a conversation by a group of women, for example. You might not like what they say and you may not agree with them, but there's a big difference between not liking something and being harassed by it. I just wondered what your views are, Elaine, in that sort of context.
Yeah, I agree. And I think what we are going to see is much closer scrutiny around harassment and when that line is crossed. And I can really see a line of cases evolving in this area where someone, if you make inappropriate comments, makes them in a way that they're not perhaps directed at someone, but if you might say it loud enough that they're overheard, I don't think that's your get out of jail free card to say, but I wasn't speaking to that person. But in effect, you indirectly are, because you're saying it at sort of such a volume, or you're purposely making comments when they come in. But again, that's so fact sensitive that I think actually it's going to be quite hard. And I think we're going to see a real evolution of case law of when is something overheard, as opposed to when is it directed. And that all goes then into what's the effect subjectively that the individual says it has on them, and is that reasonable? So I think this is going to be a really interesting area of case law that will develop over time.
I agree. And I think what you've just said gets to the heart of the so-called banter ban. There's no doubt that there'll be some sectors that are likely to be in the front line about this. So the hospitality sector, for example, springs to mind. But there's lots of other situations where a staff will be dealing with members of the general public, so hospital shops. And they are all places where staff may either be targeted by customers or may overhear conversations that aren't directed at them, but which upset them nonetheless.
Yeah, I think you're right, Jo. And lots of employers at the moment are trying to get to grips with this exact scenario, although the government does seem to be quite dismissive of the concerns that employers have raised about it. And there is still a lot of confusion about the rights of customers to express their views, free speech, and the duties that employers have to their staff.
Yeah, you're right. I don't think the government has been very helpful on this at all. They've not given businesses a clear steer about how they go about balancing competing rights, because that's effectively what we're talking about here. And I know that they've said that it's not necessary to carve out certain types of conversation from the bill, such as those around politics, religion, or social opinions. And they say that they're not prepared to do that because employers are only required to take reasonable steps to prevent harassment. And they're basically saying that any step that you take that would disproportionately interfere with a customer's right to freedom of expression would not be a reasonable step. But I'm not sure that's clear enough. And I don't think it really helps employers to understand, as you say, where the line should be drawn. And I'm, you know, you've more or less made the same point. So I'm guessing you agree with that.
Yeah, I do. And I think where we're putting employers in a position to balance those competing considerations, I do think it's only reasonable that employers are seeking better and clearer guidance. Now, the government has said a couple of things to try and calm down those concerns. So firstly, it said that employers won't be penalised for failing to take unworkable or impractical steps. For example, employers won't be required to foresee the wholly or unforeseeable or to police or customers' private conversations. And secondly, they've said that there's no expectation that employers will be able to stop all harassment from ever occurring to their employees, or that they should be expected to intervene directly in all incidents, because they've said that would be impossible.
I think employers need more than that. And I suppose we'll have to hope that ACAS or the Equality and Human Rights Commission provides some guidance to help them. But of course, we know that in terms of codes of practice, the Equality and Human Rights Commission isn't going to be updating its employment code of practice for quite some time yet. I mean, and that process will take months, given how big the entire code is.
Yeah, I agree. But it is interesting that the bill says that the government is going to produce separate regulations which will set out what steps are likely to be reasonable in the context of sexual harassment, but not otherwise. So employers are going to get a steer on what they have to do to prevent sexual harassment, which might be adaptable to other types of harassment as well. But we'll just have to wait and see on that.
All right, then. So let's move on then to look at the steps employers need to take to prepare more generally. So we have some data which suggests that certain types of third party harassment are much more prevalent than others. And the big issue appears to be sexual harassment. So some data that I saw recently, which I think it appeared in some response to the bill, either been prepared by the government or been submitted to them, I can't remember offhand, but it basically said that 25% of those people who have been sexually harassed at work say that this was done by a third party rather than a colleague. So that's, we're talking about quite high numbers there. And I think that might be the reason why the government is focusing its attention on this. And if you can compare that then with other types of third party harassment, that affects a much smaller number of people. And the data that I've looked at suggests that that's around 9.2%. So what's your advice, Elaine, then, in terms of what employers need to do in their workplaces?
So I think the starting point is to assess the risks in your workplace. And obviously, that's going to be different for each employer, depending on the size and nature of the business, your sector, etc. But if your colleagues have contact with third parties, mainly over the phone, then, for example, the risks are very different to those staff. That those risks that staff might experience if they're working in a busy bar or a restaurant where people might be drinking and therefore more likely to be noisy, unfettered behaviours, etc. So you really should have a risk assessment in place already for preventing sexual harassment. So you could look to that as a first step and see how you can adapt that more widely to harassment more generally. Mm-hmm. I'd also recommend that you do some sort of pulse survey. So ask your staff what's going on. If you can, try to do that with anonymous feedback, because anonymous surveys are often better because people are much more likely to be honest about what's happened, either to respond in the first place or give you a really accurate and truthful response. Once you've done that and you've taken stock of where your risks are at the moment, you've then got to consider, well, what can you do to reduce these risks? And again, it's going to depend on the type of business that you run. So if we go back to my earlier examples, if you've got a call centre and people are mainly having contact with third parties over the phone, review your protocols. Have you got procedures in place to refer callers to someone more senior if they become abusive or inappropriate? Or do you empower staff to warn and then put the phone down to end the call if they need to? Now, it's obviously going to be much harder to deal with that situation if you're in the hospitality or retail sector. So some examples that we've seen are that posters are being put up to say that employers or businesses won't tolerate abusive behaviour towards staff. You can also add it to terms and conditions. So if you are a restaurant and you do online bookings, then it can be part of your terms and conditions that, you know, appropriate behaviour is expected and any inappropriate behaviour will not be tolerated. But you'll also need to issue guidance to managers to say, well, in appropriate circumstances and where necessary, where should they be intervening and how can they do that safely? Because you don't want to escalate problems and for your staff to get physically hurt. So again, that's a balancing exercise of what you're encouraging staff to do and how. And of course, you know, you may have to think about having policies in place to ban some people if their behaviour is particularly unacceptable or serious, or they keep repeating that behaviour when they've been given due warning. And always, always, you have to give staff ways to raise any issues and to handle complaints, not only from dealing with the harassment point of view and that incident in the moment, but it's really important that you collect that data so that you can then continue to do the risk assessments and reevaluate the measures that you have in place, because this is going to be an ongoing process.
Yeah. And of course, it's not just a problem for HR to solve, is it?
No, it's not. Absolutely. So HR need to raise awareness, but it's really the business leaders and the managers that need to engage, because they need to be involved in assessing the risk and helping to identify ways to reduce those risks.
Thank you, Elaine. Before we move on, I'm interested in your thoughts about the type of staff employers will want to employ, particularly in high risk settings, so bars and clubs, that sort of thing. And I can't see that they'll want to employ people who are easily offended and who might raise issues all the time about behaviour that doesn't objectively amount to harassment. They're going to want to employ robust people that don't take offence at the drop of a hat, aren't they?
Yes and no. And I know you say that a little bit tongue-in-cheek, Jo, but on the one hand, having more robust staff would be the easy short-term benefit, but then you're not addressing the underlying issue. Third-party harassment does happen. And so whilst we might be critical about the way that the government is going about this and the lack of guidance and certainty for employers, at the same time, the employers that we work with want their colleagues to feel safe and comfortable in the work environment. And so if you just went out and decided to employ robust people, in quotation marks, you're masking a problem. And I don't think that's the thing that a lot of employers will want to do. And that's looking at kind of the situation a little bit tongue in cheek, but actually the serious considerations underneath are you don't want to take steps now that will undermine your overall culture or commitments to diversity, inclusion, career progression. And if we look at it as well, particularly with the employment law lens, you have to remember that you can't put in place discriminatory requirements when recruiting. You can't refuse to recruit someone with strong views on a particular issue because you're worried about how they will react to some of your customers. What you could do in that situation is tell them about the customer base and ask them whether they think they'd be able to cope with overhearing certain conversations that they may not like but wouldn't necessarily constitute harassment. And of course, once you have appointed someone and say they complain that they are being harassed by a customer, you do need to investigate. And even if you don't uphold their complaint, you can't hold it against them or treat them badly because they've raised a grievance. And it's worth bearing in mind that victimisation claims have long tentacles, so they can go back many months and sometimes even years if someone feels that they've been victimised because they've previously raised a grievance. So, no, I don't think just employing what a business perceives as a robust person is the answer. I think it's a lot more complex than that, and it is going to hit different businesses and different sectors to different degrees. So I think we just have to be very careful about how we handle dealing with this situation.
Okay. So just one more thing then before we get to when it's coming into force. Will employers who haven't taken all reasonable steps to protect their staff from being harassed by third parties have to pay an uplift compensation in a similar way to they have to do at the moment if they have failed in their duty to prevent sexual harassment?
No. As currently drafted, the 25% uplift doesn't apply to any third party claims, even those linked to sexual harassment.
Okay, thank you. Let's finish then by looking at when this is coming into force. So as you said, the bill is still being debated, and I think it's still in the Lords at the moment. And once it's completed that process, any amendments that the Lords suggest will have to go back to the Commons for approval. But the bill itself could receive royal assent before the summer recess, which is the 22nd of July. But even if it does, it's going to need a commencement date before various parts can go ahead.
That's right. And I think it's important to bear in mind that there is actually nothing further for the government to do in respect of the third party provisions. So that could come into force fairly quickly. But it's also possible that the government will wait until it has in place the regulations it says it's going to produce, which will set out the reasonable steps employers have to take to prevent their staff being sexually harassed by customers and clients. And that would take longer.
Yeah, I think we're just going to have to wait and see, aren't we? And I suppose the good thing about having this push back a few months is that it will give businesses a decent amount of time to prepare.
Yeah, I think you're right. And if I get my crystal ball out, so it is just my best guess, nobody hold me to this if in a few months you listen to this podcast and I'm wrong. But my best guess is that it will either come into force by the end of this year or the early part of next year.
Yeah, I think you're right on that. But, you know, as you say, it just depends on whether or not the government get these regulations out in time. We'll see.
Yeah, we will. Let's see how right we are. We can reflect back, Jo. But I think for now, we've probably reached the end of our allocated time for today. So if I just do one last plug to say, if you've not signed up to receive our invitations and newsletters, please do get in touch. And the same goes for anyone who'd like to suggest topics for Jo and me to discuss. You can reach us via LinkedIn or via the IM website.
Well done. And that's it for today. Please tune in next month if you want to hear more about the latest employment law updates alongside expert commentary. Thank you for listening.
Thanks, everyone.